CEOs show up at the New York Stock Exchange this morning to sound the alarm on deficits. From APM, this is the Marketplace Midday Update podcast. It is the 25th of October, Thursday. I'm Jeff Horwich. We'll check into a new report that suggests the U.S. might not be spending enough money on the right airports. We've got the smooth Italian sounds of Adolfo Laurenti on today's economic data and why people around the world are putting their toenails in the mail.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
The group of CEOs who rang this morning's opening bell at the New York Stock Exchange showed up to make a point. They're among more than 100 business leaders who've signed on to a statement released today calling for action on the national debt. Action, they say, that should include new tax revenue along with cutting spending. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has more.
Today's announcement is part of the Fix the Debt campaign, co-founded by Erskine Bowles and former Senator Alan Simpson. They previously chaired a high-profile commission on the nation's budget problems, but their ideas didn't get enough support in Congress. Now Simpson and Bowles hope business leaders can spur lawmakers. University of Virginia political scientist Larry Sabato.
This is the right moment for the CEOs to speak out. The CEOs are obviously frustrated that neither candidate has seriously addressed the questions surrounding the fiscal cliff.
The corporate leaders back slashing programs and raising taxes, which means both parties have something to dislike. Regardless of who wins in November, the fiscal cliff has to be dealt with, or else devastating defense and domestic cuts happen in January. Maya McGinnis is president of the group behind the Fix the Debt campaign.
The day after the election, focus all turns to what are we going to do about the fiscal cliff.
Her hope is that CEOs can push politicians on both sides of the aisle to make tough choices. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Even though people have been using test versions of Windows 8 for months now, Microsoft officially launches the new operating system today at an event in New York. It goes on sale tomorrow, along with a new tablet computer, the Microsoft Surface. The Surface is getting decent early reviews, but Microsoft is undeniably late to the tablet market. The BBC asked Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer about that in a new interview today.
Well, nobody has a birthright to anything. Whether you're in the market or not in the market, the real question the consumer is always asking is, what's new? What's the next opportunity? I think we've done a really exciting job. I think when people walk into a shop and pick up a Windows phone or a Surface, they're just going to be blown away. But we have to prove it.
Ballmer said tomorrow's multiple launch is one of the most critical events in Microsoft history. And let's do the numbers. Well, they've been up, they've been down, so we're going to play the swing music for you. At the moment, the Dow is down just a 0.1%. The NASDAQ and S&P, though, basically flat, so who knows what the day may hold. Ad revenues at the New York Times Company fell short, and so this morning the company missed earnings expectations. New York Times Company also owns the Boston Globe. Dunkin' Donuts fans, your carb and coffee of choice, came out with earnings today that beat analysts' expectations. Dunkin' Donuts also boosted its outlook for the year. Just a little icing on the donut there. This afternoon, we'll get earnings from Amazon and Apple. Last week's initial claims for unemployment are out, and they seem to resume the positive trend that was interrupted by a couple of hiccups in recent weeks. Initial claims were down 23,000. Adolfo Laurenti is the deputy chief economist for Mesro Financial in Chicago. He's with me as he is many Thursdays. Good to talk with you.
Good morning.
Last couple weeks of jobless claims data were largely discounted because of seasonal and other unique factors. So I gather now we're past that. And what do you see?
We see improvement. I think this is good news. Clearly, we have been struggling on the job market for quite some time. But, you know, sooner or later, we need to resume growth. And I think this is a good indicator after all those swings due to seasonal adjustment and factors that happened in the past week, as you mentioned.
The other big data out this morning, orders for durable goods. The usual practice is to strip out aircraft and defense goods, which can cause big swings in this thing. What do you see when we do that?
Unfortunately, these are not as good as the numbers we've got from the job market. They are flat for the last reading. That was August. They were also flat in July, and they suffered a big drop in June. If you take all these numbers together, it shows us that probably the investment that American businesses put in equipment and machinery during the third quarter will be a negative in the GDP report we are waiting on Friday. Friday, that's not good news. We really needed to see American businesses investing more in these type of capital equipment.
And folks are wondering, is it the fiscal cliff they're waiting for? Lots of factors at play. We don't have time to get into it, but thank you. Adolfo Laurenti at Mesirow Financial.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
Ford is closing its last plant in the UK. It is shutting down the factory in Southampton that makes commercial vans, and it's moving that production to Turkey. This follows yesterday's news about a Ford factory closure in Belgium. From our European desk in London, here's Stephen Beard.
The closures will be a bitter blow to the communities where the factories are based. At least 1,400 jobs will go in the UK, more than 4,000 in Belgium. But the news is not a surprise. The debt crisis and the faltering European economy have taken their toll. The market for vehicles in Spain has just shrunk by a third. In Greece and Portugal, it's down by 40%. Ford is on course to lose more than $1 billion in Europe this year. The company is bowing to the inevitable. Peter Wells is with the Centre for Automotive Research.
Ford has recognised that there's a deep structural shift going on in Europe in terms of the market and the level of demand, which means that they simply have surplus capacity.
The company is shifting some of its van production to its plant in Turkey. There, the wages are lower and the factory closer to the potentially higher growth markets of Eastern Europe and the Middle East. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Well, we got some news this morning that pending home sales cooled a bit in September, though they're still increasing, which is the right direction, of course. Every bit of public data like this, housing, employment, consumer spending, changes how folks feel about the state of the nation and, of course, about their own well-being. And that, in turn, you would expect affects how they will vote. And that's where we're going to start today's attitude check.
And the latest poll numbers suggest
margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Attitude Check is our weekly partnership with Gallup, and Editor-in-Chief Frank Newport is here, as always. Hello, Frank.
Hi, good morning.
So politicians are asking people on both sides, are you better off than you were 4 years ago, and saying, you'll be better off with me. What are the questions that you ask along those lines, and what are people saying?
Well, we have one very good question where we say, are you better off personally, your personal finances, than a year ago? The bottom line now is 38% of Americans say they are better off financially than a year ago, and 34% say worse off. When Obama took office, only 23% said that they were better off, so clearly it's better than when Obama took office. And when we look back in history, it actually looks like Obama's in a better position, for one thing, than where that number was for the three presidents who lost their bids for re-election, going back to Gerald Ford in 1976.
Now, I suspect the pollster never really wants his poll to be the object of attention. And in recent days, your daily tracking poll for the presidential race has gotten more attention than I'm sure you'd like. Near as I can tell, you're taking heat from both sides for swinging too wildly or whatever it is. How do you interpret the complaints against you, and what do you say to them?
Well, the complaints aren't new. Anybody that ventures into the political field is going to get criticized, particularly in a highly polarized environment that we're in now. You know, a lot of moving parts here. We at Gallup do it somewhat differently than other people. We think we do it better. We have a lot of scientists and methodologists trying to put our best minds at measuring where people are. Things do change. Otherwise, why are these candidates spending hundreds of millions of dollars, even as we speak out there trying to change people's minds?
You're tracking the popular result, and the Electoral College, on the other hand, is quite a different thing. Does it look like maybe we're heading for some repeat of 2000, where the Electoral College and the popular vote don't agree?
We are seeing nationally, one of the reasons Romney's been doing better is he's doing better in the South. Now, there are only about three of those southern states that are swing states, Florida, North Carolina, and Virginia, and all the rest doesn't really help him because he's probably going to win those states anyhow through the South and into Texas. But if he piles up the popular votes in those red states, then it is possible under some scenarios that he could win the popular vote because that's a very big region. And yet because certain states in the Midwest and maybe New Hampshire and Colorado go for Obama, he could lose the Electoral College. Probably not a high probability occurrence, but we would have said that if we're talking here before 2000, and it occurred then, so it could occur again.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at Gallup, thank you.
My pleasure.
International air travel to and from the U.S. has more than doubled in the last 20 years. 152 million trips were made in 2011. That's from a new report this morning from the Brookings Institution. And Brookings took a deeper look at those numbers, tabulating which airports are key to this extraordinary global movement of people. Brookings Senior Research Associate Adi Tomer is one of the authors of that study. Good to talk with you.
Good to talk with you.
One of the things that this report is able to confirm for the first time is that, well, people fly out of lots of different cities. Some cities are clearly much more important than others, right?
Yeah, there are 17 metropolitan gateways, which handle the majority of through traffic coming in and out of the country. So places like New York, Charlotte, San Francisco, Seattle are incredibly important to the entire country.
Does this suggest to you at all that our federal aviation infrastructure policies need to change?
So over 90% of both domestic and international passengers in the United States travel through the 100 largest metropolitan areas. At the same time, though, the major federal capital grant program sends only 36% of funding to those particular airports. This puts the responsibility on the airports in those metropolitan areas to find capital funding more on their own.
Well, the federal government helps prop up small airports where service is limited. These busy airports collect rent from the airlines, basically. They get a fee from every ticket sold. How do we know that they can't take care of themselves?
The majority of funds that the largest airports in the country use for their capital investments come from the private bond market. So this is a situation where they're already going on their own. The problem here, though, is that certain federal regulations classify some of their bonds as non-tax exempt. These makes these bonds less attractive to investors out there. And at the end of the day, then it costs these airports even more on the bond markets to get the revenues they need. We need to make sure that the municipal bonds that airports issue, every single one of them is classified as tax exempt from the alternative minimum tax. This is going to lead to better infrastructure quality for consumers on the ground and improved airport capacity and things of that nature for the airlines that operate in them.
Adi Tomer with the Brookings Institution. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you.
On that note, while we're talking air travel, news this morning that one of the last international airlines without an online booking system finally has one. Check out the new website of Air Koryo out of North Korea. Now, in theory, you can book travel between Pyongyang and Vladivostok, Beijing, or Shenyang, which is China's major city that's near the North Korean border. But before you book your NK getaway, two caveats. First, you still need a visa. That's presumably no easier than it ever has been. And second, Air Koryo, you should know, is the world's only airline rated one star. And I was checking reviews this morning, just curious. Here's one from Skytrax.com that says the plane was ancient, the food was revolting, and the two-hour trip featured a continuous loop of the same North Korean concert. Happy travels. And finally, I presume most of you by the time you're listening to this have had your breakfast, so we'll forge ahead. The Chinese embassy in South Africa is preparing for an influx of suspicious packages. Specifically, they're getting ready for lots of envelopes containing toenail clippings. And here's what's going on. Okay, many Chinese people value rhino horn as a traditional medicine. And some of those rhino horns come from rhinos poached in Africa. No doubt about that. Now, rhino horns are made of keratin, which is the same stuff as our toenails. And this is where this all comes together. So a South African activist has launched an international campaign on YouTube calling on people to put their toenail clippings in the mail, addressed to the Chinese embassy in Pretoria. Not entirely clear, looking through this stuff, whether the idea is just to protest or to actually suggest an alternative supply for Chinese medicine. That's all for the Marketplace Midday Update podcast today. I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is APM, American Public Media.